This is Scott Becker with Becker's Healthcare. I'm thrilled today to be joined by Gene Woods. Gene is the Chief Executive Officer of Atrium Health. He's also served as the chair of the American Hospital Association, a terrific leader. We're thrilled to have him on today. Gene, can you take a moment to introduce yourself and tell us a little bit about your background?
Yeah, well, thanks for the opportunity to have a conversation. I always like to be with you, Scott. Yeah, I guess I would say that my father was a military veteran, so moved around a lot as a child. And actually, when I was 4 years old, we moved to Rota, Spain, where my mother is from, Jerez de la Frontera. So sort of had a little bit of an international upbringing. My father was an aeronautics mechanic, and so he used to have this saying that, you know, if you have the right tools, you can fix anything. And so I think as I became a young adult, I came to realize he didn't just mean that literally, but also figuratively in terms of having, you know, the right tools of an education. So I actually was the first college graduate of my family, went to Penn State. We're having a pretty good year this year in football. But so that's a little bit about Gene. Career-wise, I've just been in the field, hard to believe, almost 30 years. And, you know, fortunate to see it from many different angles. You mentioned the chair of the AHA in 2017, which certainly was a highlight. But I've also had leadership roles in health systems from rural Pennsylvania to, you know, major teaching hospital in the nation capital, all the way to Santiago, Chile, and now in the Carolinas and Georgia. So I just feel blessed to have selected this as a vocation.
Take one moment, if you don't mind, and talk about your children. I've heard you talk about them before, and very impressive and great kids. Just a moment.
Yeah, I have two boys, 24 and 19. My oldest is they're actually both computer engineers. My oldest is in grad school at GW. My youngest will be running track and studying engineering for Yale. So I just couldn't be more proud of them. I told them that I could tell early on that they were smarter than their father. Now it's a matter of whether they can work as hard as their father. So, but they're doing great. I feel blessed to have two boys that are just doing great things and are just good people.
Thank you. Since you've taken over at Atrium, I'm not sure if it was when you were there right before you that you changed the name from Carolina's Health System to Atrium to reflect sort of the bigger footprint, the more national presence, but also it's grown from $5 or $6 billion to an $11 billion plus health system, which is not the dollars aren't important, but the size and magnitude of what you do is important. Tell us about some of the big initiatives since you've taken over.
Yeah, we had really, I joined in 2016. We had three initiatives. We called our Destination 2020 strategy. One is just a big affordability agenda, and we set a course to drive over $300 million in efficiencies by the end of 2020, and happy to say we're ahead of schedule, and obviously that's something that all healthcare leaders will be doing for the balance of their career. We're looking at 2025, and we think that we're going to have to double or triple that amount of efficiencies, but that was a big driver when I first came. Value, we launched one of the nation's larger ACOs and formed a clinically integrated network with over 3,000 providers. And recently, actually, our quality scores were in the top quintile nationwide. So working in physicians in new ways and through that structure has been something that I started since I've been here. And then finally, what we call this next generation network, and you alluded to the name change, that actually happened when we said we have aspirations to grow with other like-minded partners just beyond the Carolinas, and Carolina's healthcare system wasn't the name that we thought we could do that as a platform, so we changed it to Atrium. Last year, we brought Navison Health out of Macon, Georgia into the Atrium family. We just are announcing Floyd Health in Rome, Georgia, right outside of Atlanta. We'll be joining the family as well. And then we finalized our agreement with Wake Forest Baptist Medical Center. They've grown into about a $3.6 billion organization under the leadership of Dr. Julie Freischlag, who's just an amazing, amazing individual. She's CEO of Wake Forest. She's a dean. She's a practicing surgeon. So, you know, our vision is to combine these respective talents and organizations to create the nation's leading modern academic health system. And that in Charlotte, that's going to include, we'll start in 2020 on building a medical school in Charlotte. Yeah, we are one of the largest cities in the country without a medical school. And that'll be the second campus of Wake Forest. And then we'll be making significant investments in research and innovation in the core in Winston, but also here in Charlotte. So that's what we call our next generation network strategy. And really excited by the type of organizations that we're forming strategic combinations with.
You've done a tremendous job of both growing the footprint, increasing the quality, and focusing on cost containment. Do you ever think, does it ever feel exhausting? And if so, how come you always seem so energized and so positive?
Well, because this is, you know, I don't think I've ever lost the passion for why I got into healthcare to begin with. And you really have to step back, even in the most challenging days, the privilege to be able to make decisions and really play a role in impacting communities. I've never lost that passion. Nothing about the complexities of healthcare make me forget that. And every morning, in fact, I take 15 to 20 minutes before I get into the office. And I just have some quiet moments to remind myself as I go in, you know, we got patients that are sick and vulnerable and are struggling with major issues. And so it's my responsibility to come in and have an optimistic view on where we're going, what we're doing, how we're caring for them. So that's why I'm always jazzed walking in the halls of any of our facilities or out in the community.
You're one of the most articulate people on the need to sort of invest in communities, not just be healthcare systems for when people are sick, but actually to try and solve some of the social determinant problems and populational problems on the front end. How big a role can health systems take in doing this, and how important is it?
I think we have a significant responsibility to play large in that space. You know, at the most basic level, you know, if you don't have access to food and a warm roof over your head, it's hard to stay healthy. And, you know, we're in Charlotte, for example, one of the fastest growing cities in the country. And we've historically measured our success by how many Fortune 500 companies choose to headquarter here, how rapidly our skyline rises, et cetera. But we're really shifting that and looking at our collective success by the ability to make sure every citizen thrives. And really, this came when I joined after 2016, shortly after that, there was a protest in Charlotte. It happened after Keith Lamont Scott was fatally shot. And we at Atrium took a step back and said, you know, we're going to double down on our commitment to community and make a promise that when the camera crews had left, we would still be engaged on the ground, making a difference, dealing with grassroots causes of the issues in neighborhoods that felt forgotten. So, you know, we've invested $10 million in affordable housing because while incomes in Charlotte have only risen 2% the last few years, monthly rent has raised 16%. So we've made significant investments there. 45,000 kids in this area go to bed hungry, which is just unfathomable. So we started this Kids Eat Free program, and other community partners are joining in. And we also actually partnered with our major competitor down the street, what we call the One Charlotte Health Alliance. We're doing mobile food pharmacies, working together on sharing information and urgent cares, et cetera. So I just think it's part of our For All mission, and we just can't forget that that's really part of what we need to do as health systems to solve some of the significant issues that our communities are dealing with.
Let me ask you a question about something you just mentioned. You just mentioned partnering with Novant and Carl Armato, the CEO there. How unusual is that you've got two sort of like-minded, very positive, community-minded CEOs that are willing to take those partnerships together to take care of some of the indigent people in the community? That's not something that happened with your predecessor. It's not a knock on your predecessor. But it's something that amazes me in terms of the positiveness that you guys both take to it. Any comments on that, Gene?
Yeah, I mean, I think he was also had the same philosophy that we all own community health. And so while we might compete on all the other service lines and things of that nature, we all own community health. I was really surprised by how taken back the community was by how we showed up together. And we really brought together all the not-for-profits that were having some a role in social determinants of health. And we brought them in a room and said, you know, we're not here to take anything away from the missions that you do, that you work on, but we're really here to help work together. And so we've been at this for several years now. And recently, you know, in pockets of Charlotte, there's a high incidence of HIV. So we've got our vans working together, our people working together to do screenings and get people to care. So I think, as chair of the AHA, I talk nationally about the importance of not-for-profits working together, even though we compete in some other ways, this idea of co-optition. And you know, we committed to living what we're preaching, if you will.
Thank you. Another question for you, Gene. I've seen the impact you've made in just 3 years now. I guess it's only been 3 years. It seems like longer already, but amazing impact that you've made on both Atrium and your community and the community there. Do you have a core management philosophy or any sort of core that drives how you lead?
Yeah, I don't know if I would call it a core management philosophy, but there's certain things that I feel strongly about as a leader. One is, I kind of alluded to it, this idea of connecting the purpose on a daily basis. So every single meeting we have, I know that there'll be hundreds of connect the purposes throughout our organization today, where we pause and we share a story about a teammate or a patient that grounds us and reminds us of who we serve and the importance of walking in their shoes. So I think connecting the purpose is something that I practice daily. The second actually comes from one of my favorite books by the Heath brothers called Switch, How to Change when Change is Hard. And in that, they said, you know, a lot of times we as leaders have this fix-it mentality. Everything we see, we want to fix, and that's important. But in times of change, it's better assimilated. Change is better assimilated when you focus and study what you do well and do more of that. So I, just on a weekly basis, I look for bright spots in the organization, lift those up and say, let's copy that. We don't need consultants. We can learn from ourselves. And then the third is just this idea of we have to, sometimes in healthcare we can get pretty insular. We have to learn from other industries. My board chair is the CEO of Hendrick Motors, and we talk weekly about how their industry is changing. You know, auto dealers, for example, derive a lot of their profitabilities from service and maintenance. But in the world of electronic cars, that service and maintenance is done through the cloud, not by bringing a car in physically. So we talk about that. I try to learn from his industry and other industries because I think there's sometimes there are more parallels than what we might think.
Thank you. When you sort of, I'm going to ask you two questions related. Your best advice for your two sons and your best advice for healthcare leaders. And is it the same advice?
That's a very good question. I guess I would answer that this way. You know, all of us are focused on clinician burnout and creating environments to bring more joy into the workplace, because I think there's never been more pressures on physicians and nurses as today. But what I would share with leaders and also with my own children is that, you know, it's important to model and set the tone for your own health. Take care of yourself physically, spiritually, emotionally, and show your humaneness and your authenticity. I put myself through college by playing music in bands. And for me, I still write songs. I'm actually recording right now. I play guitar. That's always been a passion. But I find that doing that really feeds my soul, and ultimately I'm a better leader and a better person. So my advice to leaders and to my kids is, don't forget to focus on the things that feed your soul. It's a corollary benefit that would make you a better leader, and it's along the lines of what Steve Covey referred to as sharpening the saw.
Certainly, from the Seven Habits series, right, and his books, Stephen Covey, fascinating.
Exactly.
And so I think that's magnificent advice. And sort of final question, future of healthcare, and I'll ask you a policy part of it too. You've got these three different concepts floating around between Medicare for all, public option, and then you've got, you know, sort of the free market. And we're never totally going to be a free market, because more than half of our care is being paid for by governmental programs anyways, Medicare, Medicaid, though there'll be big free market components of it.
Right.
I'm not sure the country's ready for Medicare for all. Lots of healthcare leaders are quite concerned about it. Because of just, they want more access. They want to make sure everybody has access and everybody has quality, but they're concerned about lower reimbursement and the ability to make things work on Medicare rates throughout the country. My son makes a very convincing argument that sooner or later that's where we're going. And I hadn't heard that thought as clearly as he's articulated it recently. Do you have a perspective on that? Is that where the country is ultimately going, or is it not necessarily so?
It's right now, with the confusion in our politics, it's hard to really know how that will shape out. I do think that, you know, I still firmly believe that at least the ACA was anything but perfect, but we were halfway through. We've covered 20 million plus people, and we were halfway through really fixing the adverse selection piece of that, and now we sort of are neither fish nor fowl. I go back to the principle of the ACA and the fact that the uninsured had significantly decreased to lows this country hadn't seen in a long time. Now it's creeping back up. So, you know, if I step back and people, when they say Medicare for all and public option, a lot of times don't exactly know how to define it, and you have to really peel that back. But I go back to the key things from the ACA. We can call it something different, but I think that we still had it pretty right. It's just a matter of how to continue to expand the pool, if you will. So you know, obviously we'll learn more from this political season. And but you know, what I tell my team is, listen, let's not focus so much on what happens in the state capital or the nation's capital. You know, we own healthcare. Let's not wait for them to come and save the day. And, you know, we're about, you know, transforming care and taking the reins ourselves. I'm really humbled when you think about 1950. It took 50 years for all the medical knowledge in the world to double, and by some estimates, it takes 73 days now. So we're about just, you know, there's a lot of policy implications to what we do, but we're trying to stay focused on things that matter in terms of transformation. We were visiting with our colleagues at Wake Forest, and there's a physician there, Dr. Atala, who's growing kidneys in a laboratory, and they're actually using 3D printers to print noses and ears and, you know, the stuff of science fiction a few years ago. And so I think we're as much focused on the policy thing because we have to pay attention. But, you know, steam engine transformed the 18th century. Healthcare is being transformed by the digital revolution, and we at Atrium want to be a leaders in that regard, and we'll figure out the policy implications as they shift and wane along the journey.
Right, I think that's a fantastic perspective, that things with this digital platform are now improving at such a quicker rate in so many areas of care, than just a matter of making sure, like you're doing with the new medical school, having enough providers to implement all this, because at the end of the day, even with all the digital technology, it still is a very labor-intensive business of taking care of people. Gene, tell me, any other big news you want to share with us today?
Well, we're really, really excited with the Floyd family. It's a leading medical provider, an economic force in Northwest Georgia and Northeast Alabama, and they'll be joining the family here before too long. The hub of those services, Floyd Medical Center, it's a terrific community-based system, and they employ about almost 4,000 people. So they're really what you want to care to look like in a more rural type environment. So we're just really, really excited that we have now a new family member in Georgia.
Can you give me a sense of how many hospitals and health systems, and I know it's a convoluted world today, and how things are defined. How many hospitals or systems that Atrium will now be part of or with?
Well, we have about a total of about 40 plus hospital facilities as part of the family, and you know, we're obviously in conversations currently with others, but we're mostly focused on, you know, McKinsey has the statistic that, you know, 30% of integrations like this fail, so we've taken that as a rallying cry, whether it's with Navisant. We really want to help model how systems come together so that all parts of the system feel like they have equal contributions. And sometimes when you get a larger system, it feels like it's more bureaucratic and decisions are made centrally. And I think we've done a really good job of making sure that we hear the voices of all our communities and take those into account as we're making the best decisions on behalf of those communities and the system overall. So really our focus has been, how do we integrate really well and seamlessly? Obviously there's a lot of cultural pieces to that. And you know, systems grow up making decisions differently. And so we now, as we go into these conversations, we say, how do you make decisions? Because I think that's the piece of the cultural puzzle, if you will, that needs to be figured out and as you continue to adjust. But we're really focused on integrating well, making sure the communities feel that we're better together than those organizations might have been by themselves.
Gene, thank you so much. Congratulations on all that you're doing and accomplishing. Just fantastic.
Thank you, Scott.